Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Listeners, welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amber Nickel, the host of the channel, and today we're going to be talking with Katarina Fridla and Marcus Nesselroth about their most recent publication, Polish Jews in the Soviet Union, 1939 to 1959, History and Memory of Deportation, Exile, and Survival, which came out last year on Academic Studies Press. Katarina Fridla holds a PhD from the Department of History in the Institute of Eastern European and Jewish History at the University of Basel in Switzerland. She has published extensively on Jews in Poland and the Soviet Union and is getting ready to start a new position as the curator of European collections at the Hoover Institution Library and Archives at Stanford University. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Marcus Nesselroth is a postdoctoral researcher at the European University of Viadrina, did I get that right? Perfect, in Frankfurt-Oder. His dissertation research conducted at the Center of Jewish Studies, Berlin-Brandenburg, examines Polish Jews' experiences in the Soviet Union from 1939 to 1945, which I think is why he's an editor of this particular text. He has published numerous articles and chapters on this topic. Katarina and Marcus, welcome to the channel. I'm really excited to discuss this text with you here today.
Thank you for having us.
I want to start with kind of a question that I always start with writers, and that is, what motivated you to compile this particular text, Polish Jews in the Soviet Union, 1939 to 1959?
So the idea for this book originated at an international conference at the Pauline Museum of the History of Polish Jews in Warsaw in October 2018, Marcus and I organized. I have to mention that in the recent years, a growing number of papers, books, lectures, or exhibitions are oriented towards the subject of Polish Jewish refugees, the paradox of their survival and the memory of that survival in a more in-depth, detailed approach. But both of us felt that the story of Polish Jewish survival in the Soviet Union deserved more attention within the international and especially Polish historiography of the Holocaust and the Second World War. So we invited around 30 researchers from Poland, the USA, Russia, Israel, Canada, Australia, and Germany. During our discussions and debates, we were able to summarize the state of research, but the participants also focused on extending the research field in the interdisciplinary subjects that would require sophisticated historians with appropriate language skills and well-oriented in the vastness of the archival sources. Already during our meeting in Warsaw, we realized that it would be great to publish some of the papers in a joint volume. Most chapters in our book were presented at this meeting, while a few contributors joined us later. So starting to work on this anthology, we wanted first to present the latest findings by some of the best known scholars in the field. Secondly, we wanted to stimulate and expand the discussion on this subject simultaneously to integrate it into a larger picture and show that this story is a part of the history of Poland, the Soviet Union, Germany, Israel, the Holocaust and the Gulag, and of course, as a part of the history of those third countries where the repatriates settled after the war.
In your introduction, you explained the complexities of your topic, Polish Jews in the Soviet Union, especially from 1939 to 1959. What makes this particular group of Jews during this particular moment and place and time so difficult to define?
Yeah, this is a very good question. In the book, we speak of Polish Jews in the Soviet Union as one collective. But we have to distinguish. One way to do that would be to ask whether they experienced any persecution or forced labor, because roughly one in four Polish Jews in the Soviet Union was imprisoned in either a labor camp or in a prison. Yet the majority of Polish Jews in the Soviet Union did not experience persecution, but lived in a relatively normal Soviet life under the conditions of war until the end of 1945. Another way to look at the collective would be to ask for citizenship. So membership in one of the Polish armies or the Soviet forces. Or one more way, did the Polish Jews return to Poland after the war, or did they stay in the Soviet Union? So this is why the time frame reaches up to 1959 and not, for example, just 1945, the end of the war. Because in 1959, many of those who had decided to remain in the Soviet Union returned or left the country, chose to leave the country, and for example, went to Israel. So the umbrella term is Polish Jews in the Soviet Union, but what we do in the book is to look at smaller collectives, smaller groups of people who belonged to this umbrella term, but you know, are very difficult to define. And that's why we use this one umbrella term and go much more into detail in the chapters of the book.
So why is it important, I think, for scholars to think about Polish Jews in the Soviet Union in relation to both the Holocaust and the post-war period? What I'm trying to ask, I guess, in other words, is how does this change the way that we think about the Holocaust, about the post-war, about the Jewish experience?
So the history of survival of three quarters of the small number, actually, of surviving Polish Jews, calling themselves in Hebrew Sherit HaPleta, which means in English the surviving remnants, is a history of forced Soviet refuge. It actually contradicts the dominant understanding of being saved from the Holocaust, a very complex and misleading history of survival when placed on the verge of traditional Holocaust narratives. It undermines the principal plot of these stories of Jewish suffering from the German terror and Polish suffering in Siberia. What is important to mention is the fact that there is a growing interest in spatial turn of Holocaust studies. Athena Grossman called it, as you know, remapping the Holocaust. So the history of the Holocaust, but more specifically, the experience of those who escaped it outside Nazi-occupied Europe, has received more attention in a global on a global level. So this broader research perspective opened up a new path to writing a global history of Jewish wartime experience. So far, our subject of research fits, of course, in this trend. One center of an eerie reflection on Polish-Jewish survival in the Soviet Union were the Jewish displaced persons camps in Allied-occupied Germany. Since the late 90s, growing research on post-war DP history highlighted the fact that the most Polish Jewish DPs had spent the war in the depth of the Soviet Union. Preceding the research on Jewish DPs, the Holocaust had moved to the center of the 20th century history. At the same time, research on refugee experiences in the Soviet Union, but also in Palestine, in China, Iran, South America, or elsewhere, has contributed to widening also the definition of the Holocaust and Holocaust survival. Getting to know the history of Polish Jews in the Soviet Union may lead to a better understanding of research topics that have not been associated with this story so far. One example may be the discussion on the term survivor in Holocaust studies, which is still being discussed both in academia but also in the public sphere. So the survival of Polish Jews in the interior of the USSR is a history of course, forced Soviet refuge, but at the same time is a part of a larger story of the Second World War and, of course, of the Holocaust.
As we mentioned, I think already, this is an edited collection, which means you brought together several different scholars that are working on this topic. We obviously can't discuss all of these today, despite my willingness and desire to do so. So interviewer's prerogative, I want to talk a little bit about your own contributions during the time that we have you here. So Marcus, let's start with your contribution. As it appears, I think earlier in the text, it's the first one after the introduction. Using five individual case studies, you examine two moments of Jewish escape from German occupation, 1939-1941. I wonder if you could share with listeners today a little bit about how these different contexts, these different moments, shaped individual decisions and individual outcomes.
Well, yeah, I found it pretty difficult to answer this question in brief. That's why it took me 20 pages actually to do so. It's because it's a very complex set of factors that influence the decision of Polish Jews to leave their homes in 1939 and in 1941. So my aim was to compare two flight movements. Just to give, maybe it's important to give a little background. Germany invaded Poland in September 1939, but just 2 weeks later, Soviet forces entered Polish territory from the east. And by that, they executed the secret arrangement between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, the so-called Hitler-Stalin Pact. So by mid-September 1939, Poland was divided into a German and a Soviet half. This offered Polish Jews willing to flee the German army an alternative, a supposedly safe haven to go to. And around 300,000 Polish Jews, or in other words, roughly one in every six Jews living in the western part of Poland, decided to leave for Soviet-occupied territory in that first phase after 1939. But the vast majority, and I think that's important here, the vast majority did not flee to the Soviet side. In the summer of 1941, the situation was already different because knowledge about German brutality, German anti-Semitism was already widespread, but the border was more or less sealed. So when Germany attacked its then ally, the Soviet Union, in June 1941, Polish Jews living in the eastern half of occupied Poland had only a few days time to arrange their flight to the Soviet interior. So just weeks after the beginning of the German invasion, the pre-war Polish territory was already completely under German control. I guess that's important to stress here. What took, 2 years in the first phase was now just a matter of a couple of weeks to make up the decision whether to flee or not. So in other words, those Polish Jews who lived under German occupation in the fall of 1941 were very likely to be killed in the Holocaust. Polish Jews living close to the front lines in the summer of 1941 had thus to make a very quick decision under chaotic political conditions. The Soviet state, its administration, and army were retreating from the Germans, and an evacuation of civilians, including Soviet and Polish Jews, came late and prioritized, as a general rule, prioritized party members and high-ranking officials from the party. So usually Polish Jews did not belong to these groups making it to the evacuation trains. So the majority of those who managed to get to the interior of the Soviet Union fled on their own, either by foot or whatever means of transportation they could find. So there was a high degree of luck, coincidence, and pure chance involved in the flight movements in the first phase, but even more in the second phase, just because there was so little time. So maybe one more thing, flight was not always an individual matter. The decision-making process, if you want to call it like this, was entangled within social networks of family, friends, co-workers, political comrades, or religious communities. So a vast group of people who were involved in making up the decision. So each of these collectives or groups, if you want to call it like this, social networks, took very different perspectives into consideration. For example, Bundists, like Jewish socialists, often saw the Soviets as political enemies on the one side, but on the other side, they were still the lesser of two evils because the Soviets didn't claim to kill them in contrast to the Germans. Orthodox communities on the other side generally feared the anti-religious policy of Stalin. So usually they didn't leave to the Soviet side. So as you can see, there's many, many variables here, many, many factors coming into play, making it very difficult to give general ideas of who decided to flee. So what we have to do, or what I tried to do with those five examples, those five biographies, was to establish that there were some decisive factors, and those decisive factors may be geography. Where did you live in Poland? Close to the Soviet-German border, far away from it, close to the front lines, all those things mattered. Knowledge about the Germans and the Soviets. What did you have to expect from the German army? But also what would you expect the Soviets to do with you if you were a Polish Jew? But also access to financial resources, means of transportation, but also, which is very important here, gender and age. So taking all those things together, you get closer to answering why people left, but it's a complex matter, unfortunately.
Thank you. I want to now move on to Katarina's contribution. And I think it's a great thing to kind of spin off of what Marcus just mentioned, that this is a highly diversified and stratified community. There's no one singular Polish Jews in the Soviet Union. I think, Katarina, what you write in your contribution that really stood out is what they had in the common was that they were Polish Jews and that they were there during World War II. That they found themselves after in the Soviet Union after. Can you briefly discuss some of the different groups of Polish Jews in the Soviet Union that you addressed in your contribution and how their affiliations and intersectionalities shaped their experiences in the military?
So in my chapter, I analyze the fate and personal experience of ordinary Polish Jewish soldiers, showing a wide range of backgrounds, politics, and of course, ideological choices. Their biographies reflect also the various paths, as Marcus already mentioned, of persecution, exile, escape, deportation, or imprisonment, but also a return to the homeland and attempt to rebuild one's existence after the Shoah, and very often escape or immigration from Poland. So, of course, these soldiers were a very diverse group of people. So among them were members of the intelligentsia, workers and craftsmen, or students of pre-war rabbinical schools or rabbis. And among them also Zionists, Bundists, communists, and also those who were politically indifferent. Some of them were very strongly assimilated into the Polish culture, while others had actually very little knowledge of Polish and spoke mainly Yiddish or were devoutly religious. What is also important in this context is the participation of Jewish women in the army, and I also write about their experiences as soldiers. As you can imagine, the political affiliation, knowledge of Polish, religiousness, though personal qualities played actually a great role in their adaptation to the army, and undoubtedly had an impact on their experiences as soldiers. Joining the so-called Berling Army, which was fighting, you know, in the rank of the Red Army, was easiest for those Jews who already held communist beliefs. They were usually promoted to officers and often met old colleagues among the officer corps who, like them, had been politically active during the interwar period. While members of the Jewish intelligentsia were mainly recruited as political officers, access to an officer candidate school was also open to people from the working class and to those from very poor backgrounds, for instance. In general, Jewish privates found it hardest to adapt into the army. Many of them came from small towns and quite often from traditional Jewish communities. Also, poor knowledge of the Polish language or speaking Polish with an Yiddish accent were additional difficulties. So these soldiers most often experienced anti-Semitism in the army. But what is important to say is that active Jewish participation in organizing and merging the army gradually led to them being identified with the formation despite their background or political orientation.
If I might just follow up to that, because it is something that really stood out in your contribution to me as a reader, is can you share with listeners a little bit today about how gender informed this experience specifically?
So this is a wonderful question, and we can find a lot of informations or great insights into the gender issue in many chapters in our volume. So I can only say maybe a few words about the gender issue and the experience of Jewish women, you know, within the army, for instance. So that's really interesting because this was actually for most Polish Jewish women the first time in their lives or in the modern Jewish Polish history when they had, you know, equal rights to be active, you know, in the army, for instance. There were of course many problems, and we can see here many similarities to the problem of you know, women soldiers also in the Red Army. There, many of them face, of course, course, sexual abuse and violence, etc. But there were also very positive experiences. So many women met in the army their future husbands, for instance, and they came together after the war or liberated Poland and settled together in Poland. So I think I think that I tried for the first time to, you know, to explore their fate, so within the army. But there are many, many more very interesting stories and subjects. And I think also in Marco's case about the flights and the flight strategies, this gender issue plays also a great role. And it's a great deal.
Maybe I can just add that when we're looking at this decision-making process, we can see that in the first weeks of the war, it was very often the case that among the refugees, it was young men and middle-aged men who decided to leave. In the first place, they thought, they would join the Polish army, the full Polish forces, in the moment they were still fighting the Germans. So they wanted to reconnect with the Polish forces. But the interesting thing about it is that they were always assuming, based on what they knew back then, that the Germans would do no harm to women and children, for example. So what we know now, our knowledge about the Holocaust, this sounds, you know, this sounds strange. It sounds very difficult to grasp. But that's why many men among the refugees decided to leave their women and children behind. But at the same time, that's not the majority. You know, that's not the typical Jewish refugee at the time was a young man. Many families left, whole families left, three generations of families left. So that's not very easy to generalize, but what we can see here is definitely a gender issue involved, meaning that, you know, people were assuming that the Germans would treat the men different from the women, for example. And maybe one more thing, already in the Soviet Union, which I guess is interesting, you know, we have to keep in mind that those Polish Jews, regardless of whether they were men or women, they entered the Soviet society during wartime, right? So this was, especially after 1941, this was a society at war, a country at war, with less men than women, for example, right? So like, and of course, under Soviet communism, it was fairly common for women to work as opposed to pre-war Poland, for example. So in many ways, I guess what we can see here is some kind of emancipation of women in the Soviet Union, because they had to take care of their own lives way more than they were used to, or many of them were used to in pre-war Poland. And I guess that's an important element here to the gender history of the Jews in the Soviet Union.
I think in addition to what we've already talked about, including kind of the variations within this particular community, be it based on politics or gender, this compilation has a lot more to offer. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit today about some of the other contributions to this text.
Yeah, from an editor's point of view, it's obviously impossible to highlight single individual chapters, because they're all interesting in many ways to readers with backgrounds in Jewish, Polish, or Soviet history, sociology, literary and cultural studies, anthropology. So I would argue that each of those chapters has to offer something to readers with this specific background. But maybe it's interesting for readers to know that the book has two bigger parts. The first one includes rather historical chapters or chapters on history. For example, the experience of Jewish children in the Soviet Union, the matter of anti-Semitism, which between Poles and, or Catholic Poles and Jewish Poles, but also the process of repatriation, that is the return movement, the organized, state-organized return movement back to Poland from the Soviet Union between 1944 and 1946. One other chapter deals with the matter of citizenship, because, you know, being a Polish citizen or a Soviet citizen or a Ukrainian citizen definitely mattered during this time that we're dealing with here. But also the relations between Polish Jews and Soviet Jews, or the Soviet local population and wherever Polish Jews ended up living, is one of the chapters that in the history section, if you want to call it this. And the second part deals with broader questions of memory studies, the memory of the Polish Jewish experience in the Soviet Union. That's a pretty rough structure of the book, but we thought it was interesting to look how, you know, also in terms of sources, what people made with the story, how did they interpret the story? And also over time, you know, how did the interpretation, how did the narrative change over time? And that's what some of the chapters do here. They examine memoir literature, memoirs as sources for our understanding of the Polish Jewish history. Others deal with how to interpret the Soviet experience among survivors, but also among the Polish society, the Polish Catholic society. And the last two chapters show how show the material heritage of Polish Jews who donated personal items to Warsaw's Polin Museum. And finally, we have an epilogue highlighting future path in researching the story. So like that's what the epilogue does, is basically to say, where do we go from here? And what I would like to add is that Katarina and I also compiled about bibliography for future, you know, researchers or people who are just not familiar with the broad literature, which we already have, despite the rather new character of the subject. So we try to include as much scholarly literature as possible for readers who want to know more about the story in Polish, Russian, English, German, and Hebrew. So we hope that may help some of the readers.
I know, I certainly appreciated it. And I thought I was folding through the back looking for biographic information. And I saw the bibliography and I was like, this is different. So I certainly did appreciate that as well. And I think that you're actually like running right into my next question, because the individual contributions to this text really are remarkable. I've already footnoted a ton of it for my own research. And I think for those listening today that it will be profoundly helpful. Especially when you take these things together and think about them as a collective narrative. They give readers several different avenues for thinking about Polish Jews in the Soviet Union, both during and after World War II. And I think one of the many perks of editing a collection, which both of you have had the perk of now, is being able to take that kind of bird's eye view and see what's out there and what some potential avenues for further inquiry might be. I know that Mark Edele did the epilogue, and he talks about some of that in the epilogue, but you both also address that in your introduction to the text as well. So perhaps you could share with listeners today what you think are some potential avenues for further inquiry into the lives and deaths of Polish Jews in the Soviet Union.
So we have already a few wonderful monographs on this subject, among them the great book written by Markus, and also recently also a monograph written by Eliana Adler in English. And of course, there are several also co-edited volumes which appeared, you know, years ago. So one might think, okay, so we have quite a good, you know, base of literature and research, But well, I think this subject, and we all agree on that, still leaves many issues to be explored by researchers. So some of these topics remain politically controversial, especially in Poland, for instance. Among this is the attitude of the Polish government in exile towards Jews in the USSR. I think it would be also worth looking at the aid operations and international reaction of Jewish organizations, among other, in the issue of the Jewish community under the British mandate in Palestine at that time, towards Jewish refugees in the Soviet Union. So another potential subject for future research may concern the attitude of the Union of Polish Patriots. It was the Polish Communist Organization, which was created in 1943 by Stalin to support Polish citizens in the USSR. But also one very important question of Jewish support for the Soviet regime. And now I will turn to Markus. Maybe he wants to add something too.
There's not much that I can add, except for that, you know, our idea was always not just to tell a sub story, if we call it like this, of the Holocaust, but to actually, you know, the general aim would be to integrate this story, but also these kinds of stories, because it's you know, in the end, it's a refuge story, or a story of exile, of forced exile, of forced deportation, forced mobility, whatever you want to call it. You know, those people ended up in the Soviet Union because of the German attack on Poland. They were destined, you know, they were their aim was that the German aim was to kill those people, right? And so they were part of the Holocaust, even if they had never been in a concentration camp or a Jewish ghetto or in hiding or something. Many of the people we studied have never seen a German SS officer or you know, a soldier even, because they fled before the Germans arrived. But still, that's what we would argue. This is part of a larger Holocaust history. And what we try to argue here, but I'm afraid we won't be able to do this by ourselves, is actually to have some kind of a global history of the Holocaust. Not claiming that the Holocaust happened everywhere in the world, obviously, but that the Holocaust in Nazi-occupied Germany had repercussions all over the world, that you could meet those refugees from Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, France, all over the world, basically. And that's also what Tina Grossman was referring to with her remapping of the Holocaust. Polish Jews traveled thousands of miles and ended up in Central Asia, far, far away from Poland. Far, far away from their homes. And if we follow them in order to understand their history, then we will have to shift our our perspectives. That's what we have to do. You know, we cannot just, German occupied Poland is not the center of the action anymore. If you look at the Polish Jewish survival in the Soviet Union, so it's a very complex matter, because obviously, you know, there's still much to be written about the Holocaust, the destruction of the Jews, the persecution, and the killing. But at the same time, including those refugee histories, how they interacted with the local population, and maybe also, like, and maybe a second thing, how was actually their life after liberation, you know, because there was no liberation from a Nazi dominion or whatever, from, you know, there was no liberation for those Jews that we write about. But of course, the end of the war mattered for them. but many of the people we write about only returned to Poland in 1946, for example, right? That's, you know, that's already, you know, a year after the war had ended. Some even only returned in the 50s. So, you know, somehow this is also part of the story, one could argue that it's part of the story. Beginning in 1939, beginning with the German invasion of Poland, and ending in, for example, 1948 with the arrival to Israel, for example, a new home, or to Australia in 1947, or to the United States in 1950. You know, that's, one could argue that's all one big narrative. It belongs together, at least for the people we write about. It's a decade of forced mobility, if you want to call it like this. It's extremely exhausting to research that, but I guess we hope also with this collection that others might be inspired to follow the path and, or maybe follow other paths, but, you know, continue writing the history of Polish Jews in the Soviet Union and beyond.
I could not have left it on a better note than that, because yes, I certainly think that this particular text will spark more historiographical contribution, and hopefully we'll be having this discussion with another group in a year. But that being said, I want to now shift a little bit away from this text with our traditional closing question on New Books Network, because we have taken up a lot of your time today. And that is, what are you both working on now, either together or individually? Let's start with Katarina.
So I'm currently searching and exploring private collections and archives of Polish women active in the Solidarity movement in communist Poland, and as well as of individuals who took part in political and economic transformation in Poland after the fall of communism. And this, you know, this kind of research is of course connected with my new position. So yeah, I'm trying now to work extensively on these subjects.
And how about you, Marcus?
So I'm my current project is actually pretty far away from the story of Polish Jews in the Soviet Union. I've been working already a few years on a book about Warsaw in early 19th century. And I'm trying to tell the story of how social relations within Warsaw's multi-ethnic and extremely diverse population changed under the influence of three political regimes, the Prussian regime, the Napoleonic outpost, and the Russian Tsar. So it's, again, a combination of various historiographies, various languages, various religious affiliations. So I'm interested in that right now, and I've just finished an article, you know, highlighting some of the things about this new project for Pauline. So hopefully that will be out next year.
I'm certainly looking forward to reading both of these things when they come out. Thank you both for joining us here today on New Books in Jewish Studies. For the listeners out there, if today's discussion piqued your interest, which I hope it did, you can pick up a copy of Katarina Fridla and Marcus Nesworot's Polish Jews in the Soviet Union, 1939 to 1959, History and Memory of Deportation, Exile and Survival, directly from Academic Studies Press, or order it from your local bookstore. Thank you.